Welcome everyone. Welcome to our class this evening. Tonight, Brother Ted is going to lead us in a consideration of Ecclesiastes chapter 4. I'll ask Brother Ted to come forward.
Can you hear me? Yeah, that's good. Well, good evening all. Welcome to our Bible class tonight. Those of you who are discerning from Sunday will realise that you've got the same speaker, the same chairman, and the same pianist tonight. A trifecta. I reckon that's pretty good. Okay, now, I don't know about you, when I first read this chapter, I thought, I actually read it out to Vanessa, and I said, wow, this is a pretty joyful thing to talk about, isn't it? But surprisingly, once you get into it, you realise that it's not quite like that. And I was talking to my daughter today, who works as a counsellor, and explaining, I read out to her about the chapter, and she said, well, Dad, basically the concepts it's talking here about is what I counsel about. So that's quite amazing, isn't it? So, I'm just going to give you a quick breakdown here. I keep it still here.
Yep.
So, it's broken down into four parts. So we've got the problem. There's four problems here in the chapter. Oppression. Verses 1 to 3. And then you've got the problem of work. And I guess we could put balance, which is a very modern, well, I guess it's not a modern concept. It's been going on for an awful long time. Verses 4 to 6. And then you've got the problem of companionship. Verses 7 to 12. Yeah, and then and the other ones of wisdom, which is a nice little tie into our other series, isn't it, that we're doing. So that's the basic four things in this particular chapter. So, and they're broken down into some little subheadings as well. So we're going to talk a bit about those concepts tonight. And in the first verses, he said, I come again to contemplate all the oppression that is committed under the sun. And it's a pretty melancholy thought, isn't it? Take, for instance, the tears of the oppressed, with no one to protect them, the power their oppressors wield. No one to protect them. So, this is a problem. It's a lifelong problem, isn't it? And one of the other versions says outrageous violence that's committed on the earth. So Solomon was witness to that, Solomon or the preacher or the Koheleth, whoever it was that wrote the Ecclesiastes, considered this particular problem. And a very melancholy, he goes on, so rather than the living who still have lives to live, I salute the dead who have already met death. And worse than that, happier than both of these is he who is yet unborn and has not seen the evil things done under the sun. I see that all effort and all achievement spring from mutual jealousy. So that's another thought, that last bit. So talking about oppression, it's not something that just went on in Solomon's time, was it? It's been a common theme through all of history. Injustice. And we could just spend a couple of minutes talking about the oppression that we see in here in 2018. So what's the sort of things we see with oppression in our time? Or of recent times?
In Yemen?
Because of the
civil
wars. Yes, starving children. So, children got any fight there?
No.
Are they involved in the fight? But who gets hurt?
Mothers,
children. All of us. What other injustices are going on around the world?
Syria.
Dreadful, isn't it, when you
when you hear of, when you see the pictures, if you've seen any of the footage of drones and that taken into cities, the cities are completely nearly demolished, a lot of them. Just absolute wrecks and people living in amongst the wrecks. Where
Rohingya?
Else?
The Rohingya?
Rohingya? Whereabouts is that,
Catherine?
Myanmar,
and they're in Bangladesh.
Yeah, so they've gone from Burma, and we had the Nobel Prize winner, who, Aung San Suu Kyi, who you think, being the Nobel Peace Prize winner, would protect these people. But no one.
I think she's got her hands tied.
I think she's got her hands tied by the UNTA. Mm-hmm. What else is there going on around?
I hate to see you,
brother. Mm-hmm. Not only for Israel, so this would be a hatred. Yeah. Any more?
Conflict in various African countries, such
yeah.
as Sudan, Congo.
Africa. We don't hear a lot about it, do we? But there's some terrible things happening in Africa. Sudan. I was hearing a lady talking on the conversations today, and it was about people raising armies, mercenaries. And she talked about the problems that were in Sierra Leone years ago. And what happened was that the people who were the mercenaries, they were fighting, the government called them in to help them because things were going really bad. So what was involved, they went around and chopped off the hands or the arms of people. I mean, this is just in the civilian population, so that they couldn't work. Basically, they were no use to their families, and like terrible things. You remember what happened in Rwanda with the machete? 750,000 people died, and the world just sat by and didn't do anything. The big powers, and that was the problem in Sierra Leone. They wanted one of the America or Russia or someone in to come and sort it out. So eventually, the government had to raise some mercenaries.
They only sold about. Oil is involved.
Yeah, so that's something critical to the powers, that's what happens. So when you see this in
closer to home, you've got West Papua and
yep.
the oppression of Indonesia, so they're redoing what they did in East Timor, killing the population, and Australia turned a blind eye.
They turned a blind eye, it's not.
That's on our doorstep.
So it's right on their doorstep. So what Solomon's talking about here is nothing new, is it? It's something that's common to all generations. And people sit back and say, well, why doesn't that sort of stuff get fixed up? Well, why doesn't someone take up the cause of those that are oppressed? And we live in an educated generation, don't we? It's not like previous generations. So, but we know, of course, that it's not in man's ways to fix his, at the moment, to fix his problems.
I think the Africa examples are really good. Thing about like it's better that they're not born because
yes.
most kids end up as child soldiers or drugs. Like
that's
the
right.
whole oppression is so endemic that yeah, you can actually see what Solomon's saying here is it would be better those kids hadn't
had never been born
than what they've had to go through.
And this woman today was talking about also that other place where that guy raised an army and he got all the children to join him. I can't remember in which country it was Uganda or somewhere there. And they had all these kids at 8, 9, 10, 11, 12,
yep.
carrying arms.
Yeah, the Lord's resistance army.
That's it. You got it. That was good. Who said that? Oh, good on you. Yeah, that's what I was trying to think of. The Lord's, yeah. So it's terrible stuff, isn't it? And we live in this country here where, you know, we all live very comfortably, we have rights, and, you know, we do have people that live on the streets. It was funny, we were in Gawler today. It was went out with my daughter because it was her birthday. And right by the river, the kids came across a tree with a blanket and a pillow behind it. And they were, oh, what's this? What's going on? Little children. And we had to say, well, that person's probably slept there overnight. So that does happen. But the government does provide for everyone here, doesn't it? Even if they're like that. And some people choose to do that. And yeah, it's sad. So, and this wasn't, in as far as the Bible was concerned, in Solomon's time and before that, oppression was observed as well. If you go over to Proverbs, we'll just give you a few instances here. Go back, sorry, to Proverbs 28, verse 3.
So here's a proverb. A wicked man who oppresses the poor, here is a devastating rain and farewell bread. So oppression, and particularly oppression for the poor. So they are not able to provide for themselves, are they? Has someone else got another translation that might sound pretty good on that one? No?
Well, the ESV says, a poor man who oppresses the poor is like a beating rain that leaves no food.
Yeah, right. So a beating rain takes away, just strips the soil of all the crops, and then they starve. So in verse 16 of the same chapter, and in my version, and it says here, a prince lacking sense, like a ruler or a prince, is rich in rapacity. He who hates avarice will lengthen his days. So rapacity is destruction. So has someone else got another translation?
A leader who is a great professor lacks understanding, but yep. He who hates unjust gain will prolong his days.
Good one. Yeah, and Sebastian? Was it? Yeah. So what we see is that in the Proverbs as well as Ecclesiastes, you've got this mix that life was full of rulers who came along. No doubt there was good ones, but if you got a bad ruler and you just happened to be a common person, it was pretty sad, wasn't it? I go back to Deuteronomy 24. Deuteronomy 24, verse 14. So this is in the law, and this is what Israel was told to do or not to do in this case. You are not to exploit the hired servant who is poor and destitute, whether he is one of your brothers or a stranger who lives in your towns. You must pay him his wage each day, not allowing the sun to set before you do, for he is poor and is anxious for it. Otherwise he may appeal to the Lord against you, and it would be a sin for you. So, in other words, justice says that you've got to pay that person, and if that person is poor and you don't pay him for 2 weeks, well, how's he going to feed his family? So oppression takes different forms. Couple more. Ezekiel 22, verse 7. Okay. We'll start at verse 5. Near and far they will scoff at you, the turbulent city with a tarnished name, where all the princes of Israel leave, each one busy shedding blood and a law to himself, where people despise their fathers and mothers, where they ill-treat the settler, where they oppress the widow and the orphan. So you can see that these are the crimes of the people in Ezekiel's time, when they got a bad ruler. And in Zechariah 7, verse 10, this is one of those Bible principles that stand the test of time, similar to what came out of the law. Yeah, we'll read from verse 9. He said, apply the law fairly and practice kindness and compassion towards each other. Do not oppress the widow and the orphan, the settler and the poor man, and do not secretly plan evil against one another. So there's quite a few more we could look up, but they are all along the same lines, that oppression has been around the place for a long time, it was still happening, and Solomon, he looks at it and says, well, I can't quite work it out. But there is going to be a reversal, isn't it, in the future? Matthew 19. This is the key thing for all those that are under oppression, is that a better time is coming. And everything will be reversed compared to how it is when there's an oppressor in the land. And so in Matthew 19, at verse 27, then Peter spoke, what about us? He said to him, we have left everything and followed you. What are we to have then? Jesus said to him, I tell you solemnly, when all is made new and the Son of Man sits on his throne of glory, you will yourselves sit on 12 thrones to judge the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left houses, brothers, sisters, father, mother, children and land for my sake, for the sake of my name, will be repaid 100 times over and also inherit eternal life. And many who are first will be last and the last first. So here's the great reversal that's coming. So whoever thought they were first, they're going to finish up last. And that's the oppressors and the bad rulers. And the last will be first. So that's pretty significant, isn't it? Okay, so we listen to what Solomon says here, and there's not much point going over it. While we're in Matthew, we'll have a look at Matthew 26, because this talks about Judas, and Jesus talks about him in the context of that it was better for him never to have been born. 26:24. The Son of Man is going to his fate as the scriptures say he will, but alas for that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. Better for that man if he had never been born. So that's the same context, isn't it, as to what Solomon was talking about. It was better not to be born. And so it was for Judas. And of course we know his story, what happened to him. And back in, while we're in Matthew, let's go back to 18, just while we're finishing off this thought. Matthew 18, verse 6. We'll read from verse 5. Anyone who welcomes a little child like this in my name welcomes me. But anyone who is an obstacle to bring down one of these little ones who have faith in me would be better drowned in the depths of the sea with a great millstone around his neck. Alas for the world that there should be such obstacles. Obstacles indeed there must be, but alas for the man who provides them. And of course we could put that context into those who are our oppressors, isn't it? Who bully or take advantage of other people. Okay, so we're moving on to our second thought, which is in verse 4. Let's go back to Ecclesiastes 4. And this is the second thought. So that was the first thought that we've just considered. So in verse 4 he says, I see that all effort and all achievement spring from men's mutual jealousy. This too is vanity and chasing of the wind. So he now turns to effort and work. And he says that during this process there often comes envy of one's neighbour. So it's a result of rivalry between a man and his neighbour. So I guess we could commonly style this. Let's think about it in Japan. I don't know whether you've heard about Japan, but they have an incredible work ethic in Japan. And the word is karoshi. I think I've got that spelt right. And there are 30,000 victims, dead victims a year, of death from overwork. People work that many hours, and the government has actually had to bring in compensation for widows of these people that overwork themselves. So there's true competition, isn't there, that one wants to show another that they can work harder than anyone else. And there's not much work-life balance there, is there, in that country. And we would have a certain saying here, it's like keeping up with the Joneses, isn't it? Working a bit harder to have better things. And so this is one of the great principles in life, isn't it? That we can work and work and work and we can get more and more and more. But in the end, it's as Solomon says, it's chasing of the wind, isn't it? And I can only relate to, we've just shifted not long ago and Vanessa spent months downsizing all the things we had, putting them on Gumtree and selling buckets of stuff. And then we shifted. And you ought to see the stuff we shifted. We've got two places down in the storage facility that are absolutely chock-a-block. There's a couple of things we wanted and we went yesterday and opened up the door and we just looked in and said, nah, we can either go and buy something else, buy something to fix it up, but we're not going to try and sort it out. But that's life, isn't it? And I guess at this end of life, I guess we're old, we're 70. And some people look at it as old, and I know there's other people in the room that are... and far away. And I do think the same too. I mean, I worked hard for 50 years. I loved it. It was great. Most days, wasn't it, Matt? Most days. We had our days where we didn't have enough colour for the bananas and not enough of them, or miles too many and miles too much colour, or whatever it was. But it was good fun. But I look back now and think, why did we work so hard? Getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning and... Yeah, and you look back on life and say, yeah, really? But, of course, everyone has to work, don't they? If you've got children, younger children like David, well, you've got to provide for them, don't you? So it's just one of those things in life that you have to do. And it's trying to work out that it's a bit meaningless in a way, isn't it? There's more important things of life than keeping up with the Joneses. So, and then he contrasts it in verse 5 with the fool folds his arms and eats his own flesh away. So here's the complete contrast, isn't it? So you've got someone who works hard, and all the, you know, chasing achievement and all that sort of thing. But in the end, the fool just folds his arms. So you've got a complete, as I said, the complete contrast. And the fool, by the way, here in the scriptures, when you look at the word, it's someone who denies God, who scoffs at wisdom and laughs at eternity. So they're not very smart people. The English word perhaps is not describing that so well. But you've got the contrast here between the fool and that one who works harder. And he folds his arms. If you come back to Proverbs 6 once again, you find this term in Proverbs 6 as well. Not once, but at least twice and probably quite a few more times than that. So you have the picture in verse 10. A little sleep, a little drowsiness, a little folding of the arms to take life easier. And like a vagrant, poverty is at your elbow, and like a beggar, want. So, and the Proverbs is full of this, isn't it? The person who is lying in bed and the rains come and he should be up ploughing his field. And I think it describes it in one place as like a door that's an iron door that's squeaking. You sort of, and eventually he just stays in bed and doesn't plant the crop and and so he doesn't eat. And of course, before we lived in Australia and had all the social security, if you didn't work, you didn't eat. But now we have a whole generation, and three or four generations of them, according to my daughter, who is a counsellor and does this sort of thing. She said, I see people that come in that have had three generations who haven't worked, who have just lived off the government benefits. But times of old, well, you had to work to eat. So the little folding of the hands, well, it's got that picture of just taking it easy, just sitting back and relaxing. So if we come back to Ecclesiastes again, Ecclesiastes 4, he goes on with the thought in verse 6. Better one handful of repose than two hands full of effort. Anyone else got another translation there? That right. Okay, it's an interesting thought, isn't it? So I guess what he's trying to say, and this is probably what I've worked out as best as I could, is that rather than working yourself to the bone like the Japanese, 80 hours a week, like those Japanese people, and killing yourself with work, it's far better to work a bit, but not too much. And one commentator that I read said this: rather than putting two hands in for 80 hours a week, why don't you put in 40 hours with one hand and with the other hand eat bubblegum ice cream? So in other words, you know, enjoy the fruits of your labour rather than constantly overworking. And so I guess in modern parlance, Solomon is trying to give us here the work-life balance. That's a big thing in the workforce now for those that are still in the workforce, isn't it? Even though they still expect you to work 60 hours a week, probably. And in Proverbs 17, just go back one more quote in Proverbs 17, verse 1. It sort of talks about this concept as well. Better a dry crust and with it peace than a house where feast and dispute go together. So in other words, it's better to just eat plain food, simple food, and do it with happiness than to live in a house where there's heaps of food and grog and stuff like that, and there's constant bitterness and arguing. So that's Solomon's musings.
Sorry,
Ted. Yeah, go on.
A couple more. Proverbs 15, verse 16.
Good. Thanks, Ben. Would you like to read that for us?
Better is a little with the fear of Yahweh than great treasure and trouble with
it. Yep. Than to have treasure and with it anxiety. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Beautiful.
The problem is that being affected by both of them and ways of life. He said, I know how to get along with humble means. I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I've learnt the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need.
Yep. No, that's good. No, I think we got that concept pretty well there. Okay, so going back to Ecclesiastes 4, we're going to move on to our third thought. So he goes on now in verses 7 to 12, it's our third thought. So it's best to have close or relationships, or to choose relationships over riches. So verse 7 says, And I observe another vanity under the sun. A man is quite alone, no son, no brother, and yet there is no end to his efforts. His eyes can never have their fill of riches. For whom then do I work so hard and grudge myself pleasure? This too is vanity, a sorry business. So the picture here now, if you can just get it in your mind, is someone who's alone, doesn't have anyone close to him, a wife, brother, sister, anyone. And he works really, really, really hard. And his eyes can never have their fill of riches. So in other words, keep building up. I guess it's the modern, it's the principle of the New Testament, isn't it? Building the man who thought, well, I'm doing pretty well. I'm going to build big, better barns. Just keep building. And there's people in the world that have got incredible riches, isn't there? While we're up in China, they talked about a chap called Jack Ma. That's M-A. And he's the richest man in the world. And I don't know how many billion he's worth. But he runs a business up there where when you go to the shops, the people just have their phones. And they just, when they buy something, they just do it like that. It's called Alibaba. You might have heard of that for those in the game. But it has 870 million users in China. And that's people, whatever they want, they load money onto their account and just go wherever he goes. So he's the richest man in the world. And you've probably heard a few of the other rich people as well that control the riches. But do they stop? No, they want to keep getting more, don't they? And it's just one of those things that Solomon observed, that those who are rich, well, you just can't stop wanting to be rich and stop wanting to get more. For what?
The eye is never full.
Yeah, spot on, Jack.
The impression that this is also about someone who does actually know how to enjoy their riches.
Yeah.
For example, they could enjoy their riches more by sharing them with people, for example, in the store or whatever, but they don't.
Yeah.
All I always can focus on is just making more money, but they just, and that's all the time, so they actually don't enjoy them. They don't enjoy what they're making. They're not enjoying the money.
They die of the money.
They're too busy working.
I'm too busy working.
Counting the coins, I'm thinking of Sherlock, you know, in
Ah, yes. Yeah.
I got told this story. One of my best friends, he worked for one of the richest people in the country. So they take, before the yearly list comes out, they try and jump each other in the rankings.
No, because so those.
If he was saying that what guy he worked for wanted to borrow $1 million from someone he doesn't necessarily get along with, just so he can jump one ranking over the person that he hated more.
So it's pride.
It's pride. Not about the money, it's about
the pride. But it's a common observation through time, isn't it? And this is Solomon that's saying this, because he had everything, didn't he? He had riches, he had anything he wanted. And here he is at the end of his life saying, what is it? It's smoke, wind, it's just not worth it. So he turns now. By the way, in this chapter of chapter 4, I don't know if anyone's noticed, what doesn't it mention? In this whole chapter,
doesn't mention God.
Isn't that amazing? And the previous chapter, chapter 3, you can see that in right down to verse 17. And then the next chapter, it's in twice in verse 1. But in these whole 16 verses. There's not one mention of God. However, he's talking about godly concepts and principles, isn't he? But it's interesting that it's not in there. So I guess what he's saying here is that people should be our priority. rather than just working to get money and being isolated. If we're all too busy in life that you can't do the things that matter most, well, we should work smarter, not harder. In other words, just providing enough. But how do you get that just enough? And that's always the question that I guess we all struggle with, isn't it? There's either not enough or just a bit too much. And I guess we're always wanting to pile up a little bit in case something goes wrong. Yeah.
Somebody else has got a bigger house or a better car or whatever. And so you begin to strive to measure yourself.
Yep. It's a bit like David was saying. Yeah, you want to push yourself up the list. So if we go down to verse 9, it says, better two than one by himself, since thus their work is really profitable. So good relationships grow out of shared work, don't they? So we get more done if we have more than one. And also, two people combine their strength and their creativity and their talents and their ambition. And the other thing is, if you've got two, if one falls sick with the flu or whatever, well, you've got a second person that can carry on. So he's just making some very, very elementary observations, isn't it, about life, about relationships. And then verse 10, which is what I just said, if one should fall, the other helps him up. But woe to the man by himself with no one to help him up when he falls down. So I guess we could stop for a minute, and this is what I want to do just for a few minutes now, is talk about why community is important. So not just being one working, but two, and then it starts talking about three. Three people. Get three people in, well, it's even better. It's a bond that can't be broken. So tell us why community is important.
Encourage one another.
If I put encouragement,
people have different skills, so they complement each other's skills.
Yep. Can I be so bold as to say talents? Skills or talents?
What?
Sorry?
Support.
Yep. So we have different skills and talents. So you've got something that I don't have. We're all the same in the room. We've got various skills that we can use to help each other. Support?
Fun. More fun when
there's
more than one.
There's isn't it? As long as we can all agree on the fun. I'm being silly there. Yeah. What else? Why is community important? I guess it's a family as well on the basis, isn't it? But then community, like community, the work community, a collegial environment.
Work together for the common good, which is why God made.
Yeah,
the
common good.
Part of the body.
Yep. Any others?
It's good to practice showing love.
Yep.
Well, it's a basis for I don't know whether rituals is the word, but events such as funerals, weddings, baptisms, birthdays, just all the things that we need a community for.
Yep. Can I put celebration and sorrow? And they're all a mixture of the things that we do together, aren't we, to support each other. Being happy, supporting those that are happy, supporting those that are sad, crying with those that need crying, and laughing with those that are happy.
It also provides a sense of safety. There was something I read the other day, again with Japan, I think you know, longest lifespan, and they have, I can't remember what the word is, but on average I think the lifespan is around about 100 years.
Yeah.
And they have these groups of five that they establish where they support each other financially, emotionally, physically, like they do everything together in this group of five.
So there's five,
isn't it? From what I remember of it, yeah, but they have these little communities in this one particular area, and they attribute that to because they have that sense of safety that if I lose my job, I know that I'm supported by my other people in this group. So that community provides that safety.
Yep. I'm just going to put their trust as well, which is one I had down. And that's, they trust each other, don't they? They help each other, they support each other. Any more? But that's part of the
sharing.
That's the sharing and the celebration, isn't it? So we have sharing.
I think big picture, like looking at the context, I mean, the whole point is that we learn, like taking up from practice love, is that we learn about God's love in the way that we get to experience it or get to give it. And so the scriptural lesson is it's more blessed to give than receive.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble is human nature, it's the lust of the eyes is the first thing. So that guy on his own, that's human nature to sort of just want more and feel like you're getting satisfaction from getting stuff. It's not until you put in a community and you have to actually interact and do things for other people that you actually realise there's a pleasure in doing things for others.
Yeah.
So that's actually, so it's sort of like, the Bible could, it does say that it's more blessed to give than to receive, but God puts us in community so we actually learn that, hey, the satisfaction isn't on just getting, he who dies with the most toys doesn't win. It's about our interaction with others and doing things for others, and there's actually satisfaction in helping someone else.
Excellent.
Educational.
Yep, so just to explain that.
That's based on what Ben was just saying. We are learning from each other.
And like to do with that education, it's like passing on
your
experience, your legacy, the things you learn.
Yep. I'll just put their legacy because that's so important. Now, I guess something that strikes me, Vanessa and I often talk about this, is the way that other people look up to older ones in the meeting as examples.
So I think summary is spiritual growth. That's what community is about. Because that guy on his own is a stunted.
He's not growing, is he?
No. So it takes a community to have spiritual growth for everyone.
Yep, that's a great point that Matt said about you're knocking over. It has a lot to do with eating a lot of fish too, by the way. I've read about it. But I haven't heard of that one. That is great, because if you have well-being, it's all about feeling like you're supported, isn't it? That you're loved. And we were talking about that today, weren't we, with family, that the little ones, they feel so happy when Grandma and Grandpa come. We had them for a week last week down at the beach. So I'm not sure whether I want to do that again. But the kids, they feel happy, and they've got so many people that support them in a family. And we're like that in the meeting, aren't we, with our young people and things like that. So they're interesting concepts that Solomon talks about here. Okay, moving on, because we're getting towards the time. So in verse 11, it says, "Again, they keep warm who sleep two together. But how can a man keep warm alone?" That's pretty true for this time of the year, isn't it? I'm usually pretty hot, but this time of the year it's pretty good to get in and get a bit of warmth from each other, especially on a cold night. Don't tell stories. Yeah. And then it goes on to say in verse 12, "Where one alone would be overcome, two will put up resistance, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken." So it's all that concept we talk about there. Many people, isn't it? And the balance we have to do is to learn to get on with each other, isn't it? And as
Ben rightly pointed out, it's more blessed to give than to receive. So, and that was Jesus' spirit, wasn't it? That he was happy to give everything, so we should want to do the same. Okay. All right. So I've just got a note here on the bottom that living and working together is a great advantage to living and working alone. That doesn't make sense, does it? Something I got wrong there. But it adds four things to life, so I'll read them out. Productivity. We will have a good reward for our labour, working together. Helping in need. If one would fall, one would lift up his companion. Comfort in life. We've dealt with that. They will keep warm, but not only that, we get comfort from each other in sorrow and joy. And safety and security. So, yeah, we've talked about those concepts. Okay. So the last section is superiority but ultimate vanity of wisdom. So this one is, you sort of got to read it a couple of times to sort of get you the picture of what he's talking about. So in verse 13 it says, "Better a lad beggarly yet wise than a king old yet foolish, who will no longer take advice." So the common concept is that someone gets older and they've got a lot more wisdom and they should be listened to. But Solomon's saying here, he's saying, better a lad beggarly, like in other words, he doesn't have much money, but he's got a bit of wisdom, than a king old yet foolish, who will no longer take advice. So that's the first thought. The lad may well step from prison to the throne, or have been born a beggar in the kingdom he now owns. I observe that all who live and move under the sun side with that lad, the usurper who has succeeded. So there's a picture of a lad coming out of prison, and he comes out, even though he was born a beggar, and now he's the head of the country. Bit like Joseph, I suppose, wasn't it? Not that Joseph was not wise, but that sort of ultimate quick rise to power. And he takes the place at the head of innumerable subjects. Sad if later no one has cause to be glad of him. This too most certainly is vanity and chasing of the wind. So basically what he's saying, the way I understand it, is that he comes to power with much acclamation, and everyone has, you know, very bright futures ahead. And we see this time and time again. A new leader comes in. They're going to change the world. Like someone like Macron in France, Trump in America, Kevin Rudd here, whoever it is. And they come in with great expectation and everyone's sort of looking forward. But what happens in the end? It sort of all fades away. They get caught up in scandals, he or the ministers or whatever. So he says, well, I look at all this and I see what happens, and the cycle is repeated over and over again. And he said, all this too is vanity. So the conclusion is, it is better to have wisdom than to have age on your side. I guess it's good if you're older and got wisdom on your side as well. That can be very helpful. But it's better to have be young and have wisdom than to be the other way round. Yeah, it's better to be poor and wise and young than to be old, foolish, and have great wealth and status. Okay, so I think we've nearly reached the end. Just a few big questions for us. So, how can we discover a happy medium between workaholism and laziness? You don't really want to be either, do you? So that's a question for us as we go away from tonight. To what extent can we work without pleasure? And how can I learn to enjoy what I do? Are we guilty of striving for more things at the expense of our families, friends, and our brothers and sisters? And how can we better adjust our priorities to better reflect our eternal goals? Third one is, in my work environment, am I a team player? That's looking from verses 9 to 12. Do I cooperate with co-workers to help them do their job? And do we have meaningful relationships with others? Yeah, so that's just a few thoughts. So thank you for being a good audience. And as I said, it was a pretty positive chapter in the end, wasn't it? It looked a bit gloomy to start off with, but the eternal mind has put things there for us to seek out, hasn't it?